Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Big talk, big money, and more big mess in the Gulf oil crisis this week. And General Petraeus slumps before Congress. In his first Oval Office address, President Obama went for big BP money and big context.
The oil spill is not the last crisis America will face. This nation has known hard times before, and we will surely know them again.
In the hot seat on Capitol Hill, BP CEO Tony Hayward apologized and stonewalled.
I'm not prepared to draw conclusions about this accident until such time as the investigation has concluded.
And top commander General David Petraeus faints before Congress after describing a tough road ahead in Afghanistan.
The going was likely to get harder before it got easier. That has already been the case, as we have seen recently.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What did you see this week in Washington, Afghanistan, the Gulf? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Margaret Tolliv, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Margaret, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Also from the nation's capital, Edward Luce, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Ed, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Many thanks for having me.
Also from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and Ed.
Let's go straight to the apology that came before all the dueling yesterday when the BP CEO, Tony Hayward, sat down before Congress. Here he is trying to, this is the apology part.
The explosion and fire aboard the Deepwater Horizon and the resulting oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico never should have happened, and I'm deeply sorry that it did.
Okay, he's sorry. Then things really got going. California Democrat Henry Waxman, chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, reminded Tony Hayward that when Hayward became CEO of BP 3 years ago, he made a commitment to safety. Here's Hayward first.
Since I became CEO, we have made a lot of progress. We have made it very clear to everyone in the company that safe, reliable.
Have you met that commitment that you made?
And we've made major changes. We've made major changes to our.
We made major changes, but now we see this disaster in the Gulf. Does that indicate that you didn't keep that commitment?
And one of the reasons that I am so distraught.
Could you answer yes or no?
Is that.
I don't want to know whether you're distraught.
He doesn't want to know, Margaret Tolliv, whether Tony Hayward is distraught. I mean, this was made for theater, but this was a week when $20 billion got locked up for relief on the Gulf Coast. The president made his big speech. The oil keeps, surging up out of the ground. Where are we on this Gulf mess at the end of the week, Margaret?
At the end of the week, I actually think we're considerably farther along than we were a week or so before. I think it was widely expected that BP and the White House would reach some sort of a voluntary agreement for a commitment, and they did with that $20 billion fund. And things are progressing in terms of everyone from the engineers to the, boats and resources sucking up oil.
Mm-hmm.
They say that they're confident that they're going to be able to largely be able to scoop up what's coming out within the next few weeks. But the theater of yesterday obviously eclipsed all of that progress and raises a lot of questions about how politics is going to interfere with the actual cleanup on both sides of the aisle.
Ed Luce, there's many angles we can look at this from. You're British. Look at it from a British angle. And your man Tony there before, the sort of full American panoply of outraged Congress people yesterday. What do you think of it?
Well, you said it was a theater, and Tony Hayward is definitely not an actor. that's for sure. I mean, it's interesting. The reason why he was brought in was because of BP's previously disastrous safety record, particularly here in North America, in mm-hmm. Texas, the explosion there at the refinery in Alaska. And he replaced Lord Brown, John Brown, who was an exceptionally savvy, media-savvy, good PR chief executive for BP. And as so often is the case, if you've had a failure and you're looking for a replacement, you choose the opposite. And so BP chose somebody who's comfortable on an oil rig, but not in front of a TV camera. It's a little bit like the transition from Tony Blair to Gordon Brown. I think Tony Hayward is the Gordon Brown of the energy industry right now. Very uncharismatic. Clearly, his overriding and probably only priority yesterday was not to self-incriminate, because the threat of criminal action, in addition to civil actions against BP, is, I think, very real and rising. Whether he pulled that off or not, I don't know. But in terms of the collateral damage from his testimony, I think BP's public relations image got worse, if that's possible.
Jack, I mean, you could clearly see this was a man entirely determined not to self-incriminate. In front of the most incrimination-primed committee you could have.
Oh, indeed. He was infuriatingly terse to the congresspeople. They just couldn't get an answer out of him. For example, how many deep water wells do you have in the Gulf? I really don't know. How many in the world? Oh, don't know that. Ed said he's at home on a drilling rig. You wouldn't know.
Didn't it sound like it, did it?
No. I mean, he was, well, I don't, I'm not an expert in mud. I don't know about plumbing. I don't know about this and that and the other thing. The volumes of things he didn't know. I noticed the Times noticed the volumes too. They said that during the time he was not talking, 760,000 gallons of oil flowed into the Gulf. At one point, he got a Republican congressman so angry, the congressman said, "Is today Thursday? Can you answer that?" And he did commit that it was, in fact, Thursday.
Right.
To me, the most significant moment in the hearing was a mention of a name by, I think, Ed Markey of Massachusetts, of Ken Abbott. He's the former supervisor of the Atlantis deepwater drilling rig of BP, and he is now whistleblowing on that project. I saw an interview with him in which he said, look, the same kind of problems that have just created this degradation in the Gulf are implicit, are just waiting to happen. He calls it a time bomb waiting to explode in this Atlantis rig. Drawings that were not completed, engineering studies that were not done, corners that were cut, and he's warning this could happen again.
I want to talk about the $20 billion. President Obama was urged to, from many quarters, to step up and get on top of this situation. It was a kind of, I guess, triumph to get that big number out there on the table, but it got this immediate pushback in the very same committee hearing, famously now, from GOP Representative Joe Barton of Texas, he who we are reminded is the number one recipient of oil and gas contributions in the House. He said, talking with BP CEO Tony Hayward in front of him there, that the president unfairly grabbed for that escrow account, the $20
billion. I'm ashamed of what happened in the White House yesterday. I think it is a tragedy of the first proportion that a private corporation can be subjected to what I would characterize as a shakedown. In this case, a $20 billion shakedown.
A $20 billion shakedown. Margaret Tolliff, he was taken to the woodshed almost immediately by the Republican leadership, threatened, I'm reading here, with loss of his seniority on the committee, apologized, pull back right now, and he did. But there's out on the table, Margaret, a philosophical chasm over even the relief fund, the escrow fund for the Gulf.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell you, I think that if he hadn't gone so over the top, and I'm not sure the hearing was the right place to do this anyway, there are some sort of interesting legal or ethical questions that I think are, in theory, worth exploring, right? Which is, what are the lines of division when you've got a criminal investigation hanging over your head, and how did the White House navigate those to make sure that they didn't cross any boundaries? But I don't think there's no evidence that what's going on is that BP was afraid that they'd be in worse criminal trouble, and that's why they coughed up the $20 billion commitment. I think that BP has probably already written off the $20 billion, said, we know it's going to cost at least that much, or we're in terrible public relations trouble. Let's act like we're getting along and being reasonable here, and it's not going to cost us any more than it would have anyway. I think the real questions are, what happens when the costs exceed $20 billion? What happens when it's $20 billion and 50 cents? What's the agreement at that point? And none of that got explored because Congressman Barton's comments were
so explosive. Well, but Ed Luce, you're with the Financial Times. What do you see going on with this $20 billion? Even page one of the New York Times today, there's analysis saying, okay, the U.S. government has stepped in, you know, and demanded concessions of GM and banks and Chrysler and insurance companies, and now here, and maybe that's okay, but at some point, does the U.S. scare off the companies that make economies?
Well, I actually think in this instance, and I'm not really qualified to talk about the legal side of it, but I think in this instance, in terms of the quid pro quo for BP, the statement they wanted was when the president said that we need BP to remain a viable company going forward. And the impact of that and the sort of certainty of having a deal, of having this structured deal, it's over a period of years, the 20
right.
million,
mm-hmm.
Actually stemmed the capital markets punishment that BP had been suffering up until that point. The credit default swaps market was pricing in a default, a junk bond status in BP debt. BP was seeing liquidity dry up. It was unable to, finding great difficulty in tapping credit lines. So I think the certainty and the fact that the share price, its share price recovered a little bit after that deal was announced, was something that BP actually welcomed. I don't think they felt shaken down, in other words.
The markets came right back and said, okay, I think BP's stock went up at that point. I want to come back and look, ask you, Jack, about Obama in the eye of the storm this week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. BP will pay big questions over Afghanistan. No deal yet on extending unemployment benefits. Edward Luce, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, is with us. And Margaret Tolliv, White House correspondent from McClatchy Newspapers. Jack Beatty is here. Here's a little response from Massachusetts Democratic Congressman Ed Markey to the shakedown charge. He said BP was a company that deliberately misstated the amount of oil pouring into the Gulf at the outset. And then he went on.
A company which continues to deny that there are underwater toxic plumes. A company which has not been providing the proper protective gear for the workers in the Gulf. A company which contended it could respond to a spill of 250,000 barrels per day. No, this is not a shakedown of the company. This is the American government, President Obama, ensuring that this company is made accountable.
No shakedown, says Ed Markey. Margaret Tolliv, a 4.5-hour meeting, if this was all more or less in the works before they sat down, what were they talking about for all that time? That was a long time.
Right. It'd be great to be a fly on the wall.
Oh, boy.
We were still seeking to determine yesterday what is actually on paper. Is there anything signed? Is anything going to be signed? Or is this going to largely be sort of like a gentleman's agreement? And to some extent, it has possible echoes of the healthcare deal that was all negotiated, you know, behind closed doors. You remember with the pharmaceutical companies mm-hmm. and stuff. And then they came out and said, we have this deal and this is going to secure all this, it's going to be great for the health reform effort, and then it still took another year after that, right, to get
right.
a bill. So
right.
I think there are still a lot of unanswered questions about the process, about what is really locked down and what is just both the White House and BP seeking to restore confidence on the part of the American people.
Boy, that'll be amazing if it emerges that there's something not locked down in that $20 billion promise anyway.
That's not actually... Well, that is sort of what I mean.
It could be contingencies, you're saying, or who knows?
A lot of it is still being shaped in terms of how this panel is going to work, the third-party panel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. Even a four-hour meeting is not going to nail down those details. But BP certainly has the right to balk at the future panel's decisions, and the White House certainly has the ability to challenge BP if BP doesn't agree. So I think, you know, they have agreed on a framework is the way it continues to be described. And to me, that means, you know.
Well, these are giant stakes. I mean, it's just not over until it's over.
Right. That's absolutely right. And the courts are still very much, I think everybody believes, there for the possibility of getting involved at some point.
Let's get our listeners in here, if I may, from New York. Niskayuna, New York. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi. Huh? I was going to say the hearings are a little bit like the pot calling the kettle black because lobbying and gifts from big oil is at an all-time high, the highest in 40 years. And I think it's exemplified by the ridiculous statement Obama made, what do you want me to do, drink it up with a straw? I think the government's afraid that if they do probe this, they're going to be found guilty as well. And someone was recently appointed who had worked at Berkeley, who also has recently received a huge endowment from big oil. It's very disconcerting, and I don't think as much is being done as even was done in Katrina yet.
We've got the skepticism, Robin, loud and clear, and clearly there was a government role here as well. You could say there was some fall down. Let me get one more. Mark in Gastonia, North Carolina. Mark, you're on.
Yes, I want to make a comment about the government's level of responsibility in this entire issue. It seems like we're beating up BP pretty bad here. If you just generically look at the overall situation with the number of wells we have out there and the success rate of other companies out there and not having problems of this sort, why was it the government labored these problems that they knew that they existed with Horizon? And when is the government going to pony up the $20 billion to put in a fund to clean up this mess? I mean, we the taxpayers pay for all of these individuals that are supposed to, quote, check these situations to make sure that these problems don't happen. Why was it BP needed to have a contingency?
What about the government oversight itself? Mark, we've got that, and that's a strong question. We'll ask it. And one more. Steve in Nantucket, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. My question to your three commentators there is why the framing of this whole thing isn't more about corporate executive malfeasance, misfeasance, stupidity, along the lines of AIG, the other financial Wall Street people deal. It's the same cast of characters who are incompetent, who don't even know how to run their own businesses and then get into a solipsistic, personal, you know, why poor me pity party for themselves. Rather than Obama has failed to stand out in the water and personally capture all the oil. Why not a storyline that is corporate executive failures?
Yeah, interesting perspective, Steve. Thank you. Jack Beatty, how about it? Steve says, you know, let's look at the AIG model or back when we were, you know, we're taking the bank leadership to task. Ed Luce says, you know, the leadership of BP probably still feels under the gun and vulnerable to criminal prosecution.
And they certainly should. There are all sorts of environmental laws that have prima facie been violated, and we don't even know about issues of cover up and so on. Let me take Robin's point first about this government's responsibility. There's a long article in the current Rolling Stone that for any supporter of Mr. Obama is a hard thing to read because it simply lays bare the responsibility of his Interior Department for rubber stamping this the permit to allow this exploration to go on. And why? Well, because it's partly Ken Salazar's mission. He wants more offshore drilling. That was what he wanted in Congress. Partly because we remember now offshore drilling and its expansion was going to be a bargaining chip with the Republicans, which didn't work to get an energy bill. But in the course of the article, the reporter quotes the director of a group that represents federal whistleblowers. And this man says, employees describe being in Interior, not just MMS, but the other agencies as the third Bush term. This is the Obama term.
So there wasn't the revolution.
They're working for the same managers who are implementing the same policies. Why would you expect a different result? I mean, this is just damning. And I think the subdued president we saw in the Oval Office speech was a man who has to know, and he alluded to this in his speech. He said, we didn't act fast enough, that this is his responsibility. Salazar had a chance to challenge this permit on environmental grounds. Mm-hmm. He knew that the Bush MMS was corrupt and that wasn't doing that, and he didn't do it.
Margaret Talev, there is a conversation emerging this week about sort of Obama administration dynamics here. You and your colleagues have written about the president sort of besieged by worsening problems on a whole lot of fronts. And this little sub-theme emerging that there's a sort of Chicago-style politics, which is more about cutting deals than about big vision and goals and pushing toward them, you know, whatever the cost.
I think that there are many critics, both in the Democratic Party and in the Republican Party, and who are sort of not really that partisan, who feel that way and who think that that may be a factor when they hit their heads against the wall in trying to get him to steer his policy in a different direction or to question the trajectory that he started. I think that the administration also strongly refutes that accusation and says, of course, we're not more interested in politics than in plugging an oil leak or successfully managing a war. The fact that it exists as a real perception, not just by a niche, but across a spectrum, is a problem for them. And I don't have the answer for what they need to do to fix it, but it's something that they should be aware of, and I think that they are aware of. But these are, you know, whenever something like this happens, it's incredibly complicated. The president, of course, is juggling so much. And should the president personally be involved in reading over MMS paperwork or tackling the culture of the Interior Department when he has things like a massive economic crisis to deal with? You know, probably the answer is no. And so he delegates. And I think he's not inclined to delegate very much. He likes to hand.
The guy he delegated to is still sitting right there, Ken Salazar. I mean, there's that as a fact. It's interesting. We had pushback, of course, well, this week from Republicans on the vision part of his speech this week, where he talked about trying to use this moment to turn Americans away from a fossil fuel era towards something new. This was a Republican House Minority Leader John Boehner just yesterday charging in his way that the president was trying to use the spill, the BP blowout, to carry a larger, costly energy agenda.
I don't think President Obama should exploit this crisis by imposing a national energy tax on families and small businesses. Both parties should be working together to craft responsible solutions to this disaster. And there's nothing responsible about a national energy tax that will raise energy prices in America and ship millions of American jobs overseas.
Ed Luce, do you see a real change in American energy policy emerging from this crisis under Obama's prodding or not?
I think probably eventually there's going to be a big change in America's energy policy framework. I doubt that it'll happen before November. It's just very, very hard to see the president, even though he is working on this, and he's going to have a meeting with a bunch of senators in the Oval Office next Wednesday to discuss ways of bringing an energy climate change bill back onto the front burner. It's very, very hard to see him getting to 60 votes, given the total unanimous Republican opposition to anything that smacks of a price on carbon, and given the fact that they have 10 or 12 Democratic colleagues principally from the heartland states, from the Midwest states, who are equally skeptical, people like Evan Bayh and Jay Rockefeller. And so what he did in his speech, I think, was generally endorse the idea of legislation, but it was very telling what he didn't say. And I think because he omitted the words cap and trade, because he omitted carbon and price and those that kind of vocabulary, mm-hmm. He implicitly conceded that he knows that he's not going to be able to get a muscular House of Representatives style bill, the bill we saw from Waxman-Markey last year, through the Senate this year.
Even at a moment like this, I wonder about the politics of that. Gary in Florence, South Carolina. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi. Just yesterday, we were doing some pleasure diving at some reefs off Panama City.
How'd it look, Gary? Is the water clean and clear, or is the oil come in? What?
It had not come in yet. It was absolutely beautiful. I guess we probably had a 50 or 60-foot visibility.
Wow, lucky you.
The fish were beautiful, but the captain of the ship told us that we were probably his last trip.
Oh, my gosh.
And it just really hit home to see how these people are going to be affected.
You were right there watching those reefs and all the fish, and he expects it to what, to be swamped with oil any day?
I think they're saying by Sunday it's supposed to be in there.
Gosh. Yeah, by Sunday. Gary, thank you very much for that. Jack, just listen to that. I mean, there's the man underwater staring into those reefs and the beauty of those fish and 60 feet visibility and all that at risk here. Sometimes you just want to go off and cry.
It's appalling. And, you know, there's been a sort of trope in writing about oil over the years, and usually it's applied almost exclusively to the Middle East, into, you know, the Gulf states, that there's something cursed about it. You know, that states that have oil wealth, oil, that they get corrupt and so on, the petrodollars and all that. And now we're seeing that scenario here, that there does seem to be something cursed about this black oil. Certainly cursed for that whole region. And when one reads about what this, you know, what the stuff that doesn't show can do, the underwater plumes, it makes absurd the idea to think, you know, well, we'll just sweep it up on the surface and it'll all be fine. No. The real damage, potentially, is done right there on those coral reefs under the water.
Jim in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey, panel. I just want to say, Tom, every program's a good one, but I always look forward to Fridays.
Oh, great.
my parents live outside of Pensacola, so I've recently spent quite a bit of time down in the Gulf. And unless you're really there, it's hard to describe the tension and uneasiness mm-hmm. that people are feeling. And I don't know how you put a price tag on that. But, you know, this whole BP thing, we've been hearing for years and years now, ever since the 80s, you know, this corporate responsibility and all of this. But right from the get-go, BP has been irresponsible, and to the point that we're finding out that they didn't listen to their own employees when they were being warned about this particular rig. Now, Exxon seems to have learned the lesson for their own corporate survival, maybe something for the environment. But when they use their employees as the first line of defense, and I can't think of a better group of people that you can count on than the people that are out there that you employ. And when the president gave his speech from the Oval Office, mm-hmm. which I understand is a sacrosanct kind of event, I thought he was pretty steady, and he was right, because we could be in a leadership position now for alternative fuels. But I did find myself, Tom, thinking, I wish the president would borrow a line from Comedy Central South Park and turn to BP and say, pardon me, you bastards, because it's just, as Markey said yesterday, they continue not to be cooperative, and I think that the congressman from Texas really does present the Republican view on that.
Joe Barton. Yeah, Jim, thanks for your call. Jack, what do you make of the politics of this, then? I mean, here we are. You know, a lot of people on the Gulf Coast are really worried. A lot of others saying, give us our drilling back. This yes. six-month moratorium is going to kill us.
Yes.
Drill, baby, drill was the chant last time. You hear kind of mixed messages from the GOP right now. The Democrats not entirely sure themselves. How do you think the politics of energy are going to play after this mess?
Well, I can predict that Democrats will use Joe Barton's soundbite in ads this fall. I mean, it'll be his apology will be forgotten, and it will all be this is the face of the Republican Party. They're
kneeling
in bed with
to
the
BP.
Oil.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And so I can predict that. And I wonder. I mean, maybe Ed or Margaret have looked into this, but the $100 million fund. That's being, you know, that's put in for the wages
before the 20 billion. Yeah,
yeah. Is that going to mitigate some of this complaint about the, you know, the moratorium?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, flash floods, chaos in Central Asia, and an NBA champion. After last Friday's dramatic Arkansas flooding, Oklahoma got hit 10 inches in a matter of hours, and many stranded in the torrent.
You can see the current. She's just hanging on to trees here, guys. So, deadly situation here. They need to get over here quick.
She was rescued. In Central Asia's Kyrgyzstan, horrific ethnic attacks launched a flood of refugees before the violence. Rough stuff. And the Los Angeles Lakers beat the Boston Celtics for the NBA title. Here's the call from ABC.
Rebound, Gasol picks it out to Odom. Odom throws it ahead. The Lakers repeat back-to-back titles.
Oh, boy. We're looking at the whole week in the news. BP questions on Afghanistan. No deal yet on extending unemployment benefits. Margaret Tolliver is with us, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Edward Luce, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Jack Beatty's here. Margaret Tolliver, real quick, just before we go to Petraeus, the $100 million that's coming before the $20 billion, I guess, is it there to ameliorate these calls for drilling to get going right away?
It's there for goodwill, and I think it will probably reach some displaced workers, but whether everyone who has taken an economic loss as a result of this can tap into it, I mean, probably the answer is no, don't you think?
I'm sure. I mean, the supply lines go far and wide, and whether the $100 million can follow all of them is dubious. I want to listen.
As our caller said from Panama City, right? I mean, they haven't plugged the hole yet, right?
Yes, we know.
I think sure that these conversations about why aren't we talking more about corporate malfeasance, those will all come after the spill is stopped. But until then, we don't know what the damage is and how much it will cost.
Let's go to that congressional hearing room on Tuesday. General Petraeus testifying, talking about Afghanistan, security forces, progress, lack thereof. And suddenly appears to be unconscious for several seconds. Aides bending over him, the chairman, Carl Levin, banging the gavel. The general eventually gets up and slowly walks to a side door, seen by a Senate physician. But it was quite a moment. The CENTCOM commander briefly fainting. Senator John McCain was in the middle of a sentence when the Army general slumped forward into his microphone. You'll hear McCain here trail off as he watches the general go down.
Whether we're going to do what's necessary to succeed rather than set an arbitrary timeline. And the best way to...
Oh, my God, says someone in the hearing room. The general was eventually back to continue briefly after fainting. Here's how he began.
Again, thank you for the opportunity for a redo hearing after I demonstrated yesterday the importance of following my first platoon sergeant's order 35 years ago to always stay hydrated. I'll try to remember that in the future. In fact, my team provided me this nifty Camelback to help me remember it.
Camelback as in backpack, canteen. Boy, I don't know. Ed Luce, what did you make of the questioning on Afghanistan this week? I know there's been tough questioning in the UK as well, but here a general actually, going down in the middle of the testimony.
Well, I think what most interests me is this emerging and highly predictable divergence between what the military is going to want in terms of keeping troops there longer to have a chance for their counterinsurgency strategy to succeed, and what the political timetable, what the political clock says back here, which is that visible and genuine withdrawals must start roughly a year from now, which is about 8 months worth of fighting away, not long, in other words. And the story in last Sunday's New York Times about there being $1 trillion worth of estimated minerals, lithium, copper, gold, etc., under Afghanistan's soil, the timing of that story was very interesting because it's not new. These estimates have been known for years. Mm-hmm. Clearly, it came from some military sources, you have to ask why that's being put out now and what conclusions we should draw. I mean, minerals is no guarantee of anything. So Afghanistan can aspire to be like Congo, perhaps.
What an aspiration.
Yes, what an aspiration. I think we're going to see more of those sort of diverging viewpoints. And I do think the president's, given how little progress has been made on the ground, and there have been some reverses. I mean, Marja, it's only got 80,000 people.
And it didn't work.
And it isn't working. As General McChrystal said, in an echo of what Gorbachev said 20 years ago, it's a bleeding ulcer. It remains a bleeding ulcer. 3 months after U.S. and British troops poured into that small mm-hmm. district, Kandahar has obviously been postponed until Marja can be locked down and until President Hamid Karzai can come on side with that operation, which at the moment isn't.
Mm-hmm.
If and when.
Mm-hmm.
If that's this early on into the counterinsurgency, If these are the kinds of problems that are being experienced with the smaller demonstration effect, sort of baby step counterinsurgency operations, you've got to see a massive migraine developing here for the White House.
We'll look at the timing and the politics. Let's look first at that treasure, this sort of word put out, I don't know, through back channels, but that there's $1 trillion worth of lithium and iron and cobalt and gold. The Saudi Arabia of lithium, somebody said. General Petraeus talked about that at the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing. He was asked about the news of the $1 trillion in mineral resources being discovered in Afghanistan.
Potentially, it could be an incredible boon to Afghanistan. It could enable them to pay for their own governmental officials, forces, programs, and so forth in a way that I think prior to this, there was not that same expectation.
How can we walk away from $1 trillion? The theme got picked up in Kabul. Here's Afghani presidential spokesman Waheed Omar reacting to the news of the big minerals underground.
It's very heartening that Afghanistan has a very bright future if the Afghan mineral reserves are properly extracted. And we hope that this will be a resource for Afghanistan, which will make Afghanistan self-sufficient in the forthcoming future.
Okay, great. There's a treasure underground, but the questions just kept coming. Here was Chairman Carl Levin going one by one through the questions about exit strategy, about Kandahar, about handing things over to Afghans.
Why aren't more Afghan army troops leading security operations in the south? How many Afghan combat battalions and how many Afghan combat troops are there in Kandahar? When will the Afghan units take the lead there? Why aren't large numbers of Afghan army troops from other areas moving to Kandahar in preparation for the push? And why isn't the ratio of coalition to Afghan troops in Kandahar at least 1-to-1?
Margaret Tala, that's a pretty tough line of questions. Ed Luce lays out this, what may be a conflict again between the military and political leaders over timing here. Obama, you know, pushed for the 2011 begin to leave, but it was contingent on conditions. Nevertheless, Afghans heard 2011, Americans heard 2011. Where are we headed?
Well, and Americans were supposed to hear 2011. Mm-hmm. If there would have been a way to slice that message so that Afghans didn't hear it, but
right.
MoveOn.org did,
yeah, right.
that would have been his target,
not
right?
These days, so, not these days. Right.
From the get-go, this was controversial, and he always left himself wiggle room. He's not saying we're going to, you know, begin getting out and get out immediately. When Petraeus was asked, what's it going to look like, you know, a year later, he said, I wouldn't hazard a guess. But nonetheless, the genie is out of the bottle, and so this is what we have now. And I think that the discussion of the minerals is just as likely to complicate things as it is to portend a bright future for Afghanistan.
Jack, what do you see?
Well, you know, that 2011 deadline, or at least the beginnings of, you know, taking troops out and so on, I think that's an example of what the question you were raising earlier, that this, you know, Chicago-style politics. I mean, that was put in there precisely for MoveOn.org to make it possible for the Democrats to vote for this surge. And effectively what it did was it undercut the effect of the surge. The Republicans said so at the time, and they were right. And articles from Afghanistan make clear that Afghan officials, people on the ground, are making decisions. Will we go with the Taliban, which lives here, which is going to be here, or are we going to go with the United States, which is going to leave in, let's see, 8 months, a year? it's clear. So, yes, he got his surge, but at the same time, because of the politics of it, the deal-making in it, and maybe it was necessary, maybe it was the only way he was going to get a deal, he also sort of vitiated the effect of the counterinsurgency.
How, Ed, do you think the White House re-ups American commitment in Afghanistan then? Because you've got a certain expectation now in the public, and maybe in Afghanistan as well. The military may not like it. Obama may not actually want to go, but how does he, you know, get the country to sign up for another tour?
It's you know, clearly conditions-based is the mantra, and was from the moment he gave his West Point speech last December, and that is the wiggle room. I think you can stage sort of big withdrawals from areas You know, that don't require American troops in the north, non-Pashtun areas. You can massage things to a certain extent. But the bottom line is they need some success to be able to manage either a withdrawal on time or else a convincing case to be made to the American public and to the left of the Democratic Party that it's worth staying on. Either way, they need some sort of demonstration effect somewhere, whether it's not on as big a stage as Kandahar or not, I don't know. The metrics that they've set for the 18 months leading up to July 2011 of training Afghan at National Army troops, they're not being met at the moment. They're way behind schedule. And the rate of attrition, drug use, and so forth from those who they have trained on time, of Afghan soldiers they have trained, remains pretty appalling. And, you know, you have to ask the question now, and looking at the sort of red and tooth and claw nature of war, who trains the Taliban? Who pays the Taliban? Nobody. They are motivated. Whereas the ANA, Afghan National Army troops, are deserting, continuing to desert in high rates. And so you have to ask at this stage whether a completely different approach isn't merited and or a withdrawal.
Has the strange feeling at the moment of a policy kind of hovering over diminishing support without a lot of direction to it? Let's go to Kentucky, Hardeeville, Kentucky. Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. You know, back during the campaign, we were promised a lot of changes, that we would get out of Afghanistan, get out of Gitmo and Bagram, quit torturing, and there were just a lot of things that we were promised in the way of change, and it's like there really hasn't been that much change, that we're still in all those places. You know, Salazar was in the Bush administration, and we see a carryover of the policies that he had with drilling that, you know, Obama wanted to expand the nuclear power in the offshore drilling.
You're still waiting for the change, Tom. It was a big theme. I mean, if that's what Obama faces in the Democrats, there clearly are some questions there. Let us pick it up. Another Anthony in Boston. You're on the air, Anthony.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to be with you and your panel.
Welcome. What do you think?
Well, Tom, I mean, there's a lot of misnomers flying around. We're discussing Afghanistan in a very clear, concise military term, especially saying war. Afghanistan, to a lot of people, is a very, you know, it's an agrarian society. And when we talk about war, we have visions of ground take and objectives won. And actually, this is more of a war of hearts and minds and theology. You can't do that with 100,000 boots on the ground with our soldiers and soldiers from the coalition doing things that the Afghanistan people, I mean, these people out in the rural areas find apprehensible.
You mean when the bombs come down, when civilians get killed? I mean, we know that's tough, and maybe you can't do it. Yeah, you've got to win that, but how do you do it without? I mean, it's not as though the Taliban wasn't in charge before. We take your point. It's murky. I mean, Jack, where do you see the tide going here? You know, are we going to be there in 1,000 years?
Oh, my God. You know, what is it called? The book on Afghanistan, The Graveyard of Empires. And there's a reason for that. I mean, you know, history is history. And the empires that have come there just haven't had the same stake. You know, the British didn't have the stake that the Afghans had in staying there. The Russians didn't have, the Soviets didn't have the same stake as the people on the ground, and neither do we. We don't have vital interests there.
That's not what candidate Obama said.
Well, I understand, but you just had Senator Levin and others have pointed out, my gosh, our threat today comes from Somalia, from Yemen, from the internet, from all kinds of places. It isn't as if the threat to the United States is now localized in a camp in Afghanistan. Indeed, the camp is in Pakistan, our ally. And maybe this whole war, this whole campaign is an illusion, an exercise dealing with a problem that really doesn't threaten us.
But how about Pakistan, our ally, as an illusion?
Well, no, there's nothing illusory about that, but that is such an immensely thorny issue. How to deal with that, one even can't even begin to imagine. But clearly, for whatever reason, our enemies are being protected still by the Pakistan government or by elements in that government.
Margaret, I wanted to get to unemployment benefits. We've barely got time, but do you see them falling off a cliff here? Will Congress come back somehow and extend them, or is that over? Is the deficit trumping everything now?
Boy, I think Congress will, but I think you see a real reluctance, especially among the moderates, to keep spending because, I mean, it's just, it's like crazy. Like, we're hemorrhaging money one crisis after another, and so that's what the stalling has been. But I think I think they will come back, yes. If I can just quickly say something,
yes,
very quickly. Mm-hmm. The caller who said that there hasn't been any change, I think that's not true. There has been a massive change in health care. We're about to pass a huge financial regulation bill, but there's not changes along many of the fronts that the Liberal Democrats hoped he would bring.
Maybe a little hearts and minds challenge right there at home. Margaret Tolla with McClatchy Newspapers, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
And Edward Luce, the Financial Times Washington Bureau Chief. Ed, thank you so much for your time today.
Many thanks for having me, Tom.
Jack Beatty, Choppy Waters, we sail on. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.